Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Now, I have an area we can go into next on this, but Jen, you kind of opened the door for us just to start riffing. Did you think of other points you wanted to make first?
Well, I have just one other point about, and I don't know how, you know, much it's worth saying, but I think one of the great challenges I feel is that, you know, this idea of a world in which there's free agency and where there's opposition and that there's suffering, that in some ways, I can get my head around that more if there's this notion that God loves us, is compassionately aware of us, but can't do anything about it, right? Mm-hmm. But really is there caring about our suffering, caring about what's going on. But the thing that's sort of mind-boggling for me is that he can't communicate that love to us better. That even because we believe in a God that communicates, but pretty poorly. I mean, maybe he needs some communication skill training. I mean, I'm being a little silly, but I think that, you know, that for some of my clients who have grown up in such impoverished homes, right, that they're looking to God, they're going to church, they're trying to find a sense that they matter, and their lived experience, you know, is so powerful over who God might be or whatever communication from God they might receive. And of course, someone could say, well, God loves them. They just can't open their hearts up to that message. And I would say there's truth in that, because oftentimes people who've been so deeply hurt have learned how to shut their hearts down, right? They've learned how to no longer need or want as a way of coping, but then they live in a very closed off way. But then I would say, you know, and the person who's been loved by their parents, well, they can just feel God's love more readily because they know that they anticipate it, they expect it. But again, that's unjust in my mind, or I think, who is God to not then communicate or to try and say, I care about you, even though no one else around you seems to have cared. And, you know, to give some sense of your mattering, even though you're still free to decide what you're going to do within the, how are you going to respond to the suffering that's been inflicted on you? Are you going to go and do likewise? Or are you going to do better? But you matter. It's that I wish I could give my clients, or I wish they could access, because they suffer so much in this profound sense of not mattering.
Wow, that is powerful.
I was hoping one of you would have an answer.
Well, it's almost like you're afraid to do an answer. You know what I mean? Because we've already been talking about how answers aren't really satisfactory here, because, you know, I mean, my brain went off into different directions of, you know, it maybe takes a human, you know, presence, mm-hmm. and a modeling and somebody who's vibrating at a, you know, godly, compassionate level to begin those things, versus God truly not being able to break in, you know, through spiritual, you know, unmediated kind of ways. And again, you just wonder, you know, this whole limited God stuff, because God's clearly done a pretty bad job of communicating what God's like for us to have so many different religions, right? Or, you know, what's the best way to a healthy life? I sort of enjoy that, and I have my own spin on that, but I won't give it here. But God as a bad communicator is certainly one of those problems that I don't know a solution to. Do you guys?
No, I don't have a solution. But, you know, we hear people all the time saying we're the arms and legs of God. Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Mm-hmm. When my mother joined the church in New Jersey and came out to Utah in 1948, and there was a wonderful woman out there in Taylorsville who took care of her. Her name was Mary Lindsay, and she was a nurse. And my mother was a nurse, you know, they had that relationship. But Mary Lindsay she had a large family of kids, and she lost her husband. And she actually hid in a closet for weeks. Mm. And just, you know, she couldn't pray. She just would say, you know, why? And finally, one of her children came to her and said, "Are you leaving us too?"
Mm.
And she found the strength, you know, to do something else. And in a sense, you know, that I think what you're doing as a therapist is that kind of work. You know, that God needs us to do something. There are all these and who knows what the limitations mean, that, you know, we won't look up, or we're too depressed, or we're, you know, so, you know, sometimes, you know, people will have visions, but most of the time it's just somebody being there, and
right.
You know, her daughter was, and it, you know, it didn't necessarily have to work, but it did, and you never know what's going to work.
Well, I think, you know, that's an excellent story, because you know, she's totally overwhelmed, and then her child says, "Are you leaving us too?" And in that moment, I mean, this is kind of where I live in my head when I work with people. She has to make a choice. She has to say, "What am I going to do?" I mean, I don't know why this suffering has come upon me. I don't know if I'll ever be able to make sense of it, but I can still give it meaning by what I do next. You know, how am I going to respond? And I think in some ways for me, it's like I don't know why all of these things are the way they are in the universe, but it seems to be how they are. And so what can I do within it? How can I alleviate suffering within it? How can I help people within it to respond in ways that seem to be, and in my experience, I do see evolution in people all the time. And in many ways, it's deeply inspiring towards a sense of God and the force of good and the ability to for us to become more grounded, loving, godlike people, to see how that happens through the process of making decisions about who we want to be and how we want to respond to evil in our direction or our own suffering. So it's and in that sense, you come to know God better, but not necessarily the why of everything.
Yeah.
I don't know, Dan, if you want me to talk a little bit about sort of therapy and how I see it with related to the issue of evil at this point. Or
good,
later.
And especially your self-deception stuff I thought was really interesting. So, yeah please do. Again, I'll pick up my threads. Don't worry. I will get my words in.
Okay. Yeah, so, well, just when you posed this question to me, I think it's something I've been thinking about more lately as a therapist, because the culture of therapy in my experience is one of the therapist being the kind of ultimate, the good parent, being the nurturer that your parents weren't, your parents weren't. And it's this idea of, you know, that we all needed attachment, and that many of us weren't attached to our parents. We didn't have secure attachments, and that we were wounded through the traumas of our childhood. And that coming out of that you didn't get things that you needed. You didn't get your tank filled up, so to speak, through the love of your parents. And so when you're coming into therapy, you know, that the mean things you do in your relationships, the mean things you do to your spouse or your children, are basically misguided attempts at finding connection, finding attachments to people, trying to get the love that we want and need. And so it kind of takes some of the morality out of the question of human evil, that, you know, they're just looking to feel that they matter. They're looking to feel connected, you know, and that's a compelling framework, I think, for therapists, because it's so much easier to sit with somebody who's being very cruel to their spouse and to say, well, this person did it because his dad was such a jerk, and I'm not denying that those aren't powerful factors in terms of shaping how someone learns to relate in the world and the options that someone readily sees before them in the face of their own difficulty or insecurity or difficult moment. But it also strips, what the therapist does is tries to sort of coddle the patient, the client, in a certain way, to try and give them the understanding and the empathy and the around even their poor choices. Even if you confront those choices, you still put a spin on it that it was well-intentioned but maybe still hurtful. Mm. And I think, you know, that undermines, in my opinion, that while it may feed our narcissism as therapists because our clients like us and, you know, we get to be the really good guy. Of course, we're getting paid for it, but we get to be the really good guy. And rather than, I think, the much harder work is, in a sense, also the same act of empathy of my friend who sat with me in the moment that I was in, is to actually walk into the darker realities of the way that clients and all of us are capable of being, that we are capable of being mean with the people that we really care about. We're capable of taking, of being self-serving, and that we participate in evil behavior, not just because, you know, not because, I'm not denying that if you were hurt as a child, that's not going to make it easier for you to go on to hurt. But I see it more as you internalized a framework of relating. Speaking of the ecology of relationships, you internalize a framework of relating that becomes very easy to then enact the same evil that was enacted upon you. But you are still perpetuating evil, right? You aren't an innocent bystander. You are. It's easy to say your parents were evil, but you, client, you're a good guy. So it's to say, no, you are capable of evil. I am capable of evil, and that where that evil lies is in our self-deception and the deception of the people around us, right? So, and when we can deceive I think is in our relationships, we do a lot of masking of what our intentions are, masking of what we're really feeling, to protect ourselves towards our own self-interest, but often at other people's expense. And I could say a lot more about that, but I would say that evil, you know, it thrives in deception, you know, self-deception and deception of others. And in this way that when we talk about, you know, Satan as the father of all lies, I mean, I feel like it captures it in that, not that deception is the motivation, but deception is the mechanism that allows the evil to be perpetuated. And so what I often do as a therapist with clients is hand to them, I become the mirror that they don't want to see. You know, that often when we're in relationships with our spouse and first year of marriage, and they start holding up that mirror to us, it's like, you just don't understand me. I'm a really, really good guy. I'm not being selfish and self-serving. If you were just more like me, everything would be fine. If you were doing, you know, and that often our relationships, I mean, if I were to talk about why I think relationships are quite, are conceivably a divine institution of marriage, is that it reflects back to us often what we don't want to see in ourselves. So as a therapist, often I'm handing to people, this is what you're doing to your spouse. And not only is it good for the spouse to see who they're married to, but to see for yourself who you're capable of being. And in the face of it, it's very sobering. But I think the brilliance is in that it confronts people with a choice. And this notion of agency and soul development, that the defense of free will and the defense of soul development, I do see it in this form in therapy, which is that, you know, I have a choice. I can continue doing the cruel things I do, but I can no longer deny that what effect it's having on my relationships, on the people I claim to love, and who am I going to be in this moment? What do I choose? And often we're stepping towards a way of relating that we never received, that feels scary, that feels insecure because we're not able to take from the people we're with. We now are standing up and trying to give in a particular way. But I think that it's in that choosing that we evolve as adults. You know, child development happens through our positive feelings that we give to our children, among other things that we do. But adult development happens, in my opinion, through the making of choices that are often difficult, but choosing who we're going to be, where we're going to stand, if the best in us is going to stand up, or if we're going to keep delivering the same evil that we are receiving. And I think it's in that process that we develop a self, or soul development happens, that we become more grounded and are able to stand on our own 2 feet and really give in our relationships, rather than these kind of perverse and concealed ways that we take in relationships in the name of love. So
real soul making, instead of
real soul, and
lived, embodied, yes, rather than ideological, yeah,
yes, exactly. And I think, you know, that the faster we learn about the ecology of relationships, is, you know, speaking to this idea of who God was and how the rules of the universe emerged were relational inherently. I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me. That the sooner you learn to not. You learn from your marriage, or you learn from the what what's happening in your relationships, the sooner that we develop as people and our relationships will evolve, and the more we push against them and won't let ourselves learn from them, the more that we suffer in our relationship and the people we're in relationships suffer.
That is so wonderful. You know, you went on for a while there. There were a lot of things that jumped out to me, but when you said mirror, I had thought of that like 30 seconds before you said it, and that is exactly, there's just needs to be this sort of sense, you know, when we talk about repentance, you know, it always seems like this negative thing, oh, dang it, I should be one of those people that don't need to repent, you know, kind of thing, and we just need to simply look at it as sort of like, a mirror is shown to us, and like it's time to move. And you also mentioned about how a spouse can do that. Many of you guys know that I'm working on a big Eugene England project, and there one of the quotes that he's constantly giving is from Michael Novak, who was, I think, an editor at Harper or something. It says, "Seeing myself through the unblinking eyes of an intimate, intelligent other, an honest spouse is humiliating beyond anticipation."
Absolutely.
You know, meaning like, yeah, we need these mirrors. And I know in my own prayer life, you know, I can sort of tell sometimes when, you know, that section 121 where, you know, of course he's talking about how a priesthood leader, you know, reproving betimes with sharpness, you know, there are times, you know, like you as a therapist, hey, I'm no longer going to coddle here and I'm going to show you something about yourself. I can just tell almost in my prayer life when God's coming up to like, okay, I'm going to really show you something here. And so I'll quit praying for a week or something because I know that I'm about to be, you know, have that mirror. But, you know, eventually just come around. And I have sort of learned, you know, and I'm not trying to say this in any kind of, you know, I'm so evolved, you know, kind of thing. But there is just some, I've sort of defanged the need to be called to repentance as something really negative and trying to embrace it as a positive.
And so when clients are like, oh, I feel so bad, you know, I was like, get over it. You know, it's like, we're all human. We're all like, you know, don't be so self-absorbed or narcissistic as to think that you're somehow unique in this. Like it's just the human condition. We're all imperfect. We're all doing this, right? It's just a question of, were we willing to confront it or not? And the more you're going to deny that you do evil, the more evil you're going to do, right? So the faster you can see this in yourself, embrace it, own it, don't make other people pay for it, you know, that, you know, the more you're going to evolve and the more solid you'll become.
Probably the most famous line from Sartre is that hell is other people.
Right.
That's so true.
You know, the other is my mirror. The other is, the other calls me away from my desire to be God, desire to control and run the whole world. And you know, you think of it, you know, this is, you get Lloyd back in here. This is a lot of what we do in theology. We try and, you know, map out what God is, you know, but you see people do this all the time. I mean, all you have to do is watch TV preachers is they somehow feel that they think the thoughts of God. They're so identified with God that, you know, and this is why you can look at the other people and tell them that they're all going to hell.
You know? Right. And I really think, you know, this is just how I think. I don't think you can claim someone as spiritual if they're not actually living it. So, you know, I work with people all over the country because I see people on Skype. And so was had been a stake president and his wife was leaving him. And, you know, she said he's been looking at porn almost every day for the last 10 years. And so, but she said, I don't get it because he's so spiritual. He's such a spiritual being. And, you know, what she meant by that was he gives great sermons. You know, he compels people all the time towards, you know, repentance and what they should be. And so, meaning he talks the talk, right? But in terms of like who he was in that relationship, who he was in relationship to himself and to God, was very, very immature and very self-serving. And so I guess what I would, I mean, I know that I'm stating the obvious, but I think oftentimes we call people spiritual because they read their scriptures and because they make great comments in Sunday school or because they have a certain position in the church. And yet they enact all kinds of cruelty within their own families, right? They do all kinds of things to undermine and to devalue and to criticize the people around them. And, you know, it's like we all want to do that. We all want to have sort of a way of sort of demonstrating or manifesting externally that we're good and that we are, you know, we're above most other people. But spirituality is so much in the lived experience, in my opinion, that it happens through our relationships, who we are to other people.
Yeah, I really like that because I think it's so much tied to the problem of evil and how we respond to these things. Because, you know, in that sense, with spiritual, we want to say that spiritual isn't—it's this thing that you possess, right. and you—you know—if somebody has someone spiritual because they possess spirituality, rather than they do spiritual things, you know, they live in a Christ-like way. And in the same way, we want to look at the world as if it's this thing that's out there, that God's plan is this thing that I'm trying to figure out what I'm trying to say here, but we want to impose this metaphysical conception on the world and act like that is what the world is, rather than the world being the very things that we experience, the very things that we do, the very way that we interact with other people.
Mm-hmm. Has anybody read Walter Kern's essay in New Republic a couple of months ago?
Yeah, that was wonderful, wasn't it?
Confessions of an Ex-Mormon.
Yes.
Because he says that. He says, you know, he talks about spirituality as standing with other people. And he said at one point he left the church because that was more than he could do. He already didn't believe in the magical stuff and the metaphysical stuff, but he said he had learned that it was, you know, standing with other people was what really about, and he said that was way too scary.
Mm.
But then he meets that group of people in Southern Cal, he learns what it feels like. Good. Okay, there's two more areas that I think will send us into some good material from you, Jen, and then Jim and Lloyd, I'll let you play with anything left on your plate. How about this one? We've kind of hinted at it, Jen, before.
Mm-hmm.
The whole message, again, this is the human desire to say, okay, I've got suffering in my life. I know that there's growth that comes through suffering. Therefore, God gave me this suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of simply saying, I'm suffering, and perhaps, you know, I know I'm going to learn something from this, but you don't have to throw that element of God gave me the trial. Which is healthier, or you know?
Well,
goods
maybe
and bads
I'd say there's upsides and downsides. Well, I mean, the upside of God gave it to me is a very personal God, you know, a very, very intimately involved. You know, I have a cousin who would pray about which wallpaper to put up, and you know, she had nice wallpaper. Mm-hmm. So who am I to judge? God wasn't communicating to her, but. You know, this sense that God is there at every moment is micromanaging this learning process for me. And the upside of that, of course, as long as you can sustain it, is this, you know, it obliterates a sense of loneliness or this sense that the world could consume me or overwhelm me or that it may be greater than I can actually manage, right? This idea that God will never give us more than we can manage is part of that. And so, you know, that's a big upside. Of course, the downside is when you have disproportionate suffering or you have so much that can't be justified. Like, you know, your child dying in the trunk of a car. I mean, it can't be justified. There's no real right way to say that it was meaningful or somehow better. You know, the same friend that I said who stood there with me around my son, Graham, she died several years ago and left two young children. She died of cancer. And just there's nothing just or right about it. It's just wrong. So I think that it feels to me like an immature belief, if I were to say honestly. And I think that we do that as a way to not confront how imperfect the universe is and to understand who God is within that. It also makes us less able to be empathic to suffering. As we're all has been a theme throughout what we all have been saying, but you're more disconnected from other people's suffering.
Awesome, and that that has teased my second point, which is about embracing sort of a theology of a crappy universe and maybe that helping in a therapeutic situation with some people. But I wanted to say one more thing about this first point. Lloyd and Jim, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners and you, Jen, there's this logical fallacy or this one of the, you know, reasoning errors that a lot of people make is called post hoc ergo propter hoc, which means after this, therefore because of this. And so there's this idea of, okay, this trial brought me to closer to God, or this trial taught me XYZ lesson, now I'm a better husband. Mm-hmm. You know, so after this, therefore because of this. So in other words,
right.
it's that way of saying, okay, benefit does come. Soul making does happen in a suffering universe.
Therefore, it's meant to be.
But it's therefore it was by design.
Right.
You know, and so I just wanted to throw that out there as at least to me something fair game for us all to think about in terms of, you know, God giving us. Therefore, I am 100% of the conviction that even though God's a bad communicator, that whatever happens, there's this being of God that's empathetic and is there and is calling and reaching and always extending towards us. But I don't know that God ever orders cancer.
Right.
You know,
right.
Or a birth defect, or whatever
right.
it is. It's easier for me theologically to say that God is completely never involved with that.
Right.
It's easier for me when we go to the natural evils to say, we want a fertile earth, guess what? We got to have plate tectonics,
yeah.
and we've got to have shifting, and we've got to have nutrients come up from the bottom of, you know, the earth's core, and therefore you're going to have earthquakes, and you're going to have volcanoes. You know, I, you know, in order to get that, that's simply the thing is, I don't think God has a dang thing to do with any of those things. It's simply the way that this planet's set up.
Right.
So,
yeah, exactly.
Anyway, so that theology for me is more satisfying, though I know it goes against the grain of pretty much 90% of any Sunday school discussion.
Well, if it is precisely how I feel about it. So, I mean, it's, you know, because, so if you take my son, Graham, you know, is the world a better place because he was born with autism? I mean, one of the things that was offensive to me is when people would say, well, you will learn a lot from this. Well, there's no doubt. I have learned tremendous amounts, but at his expense is unacceptable, right? Because he doesn't get to have the same life that the rest of us get to have. And so I just can't sort of think that, okay, God did this to Graham for my benefit. That doesn't make sense to me. On the other hand, it happened. So I don't see God as being involved in it. I didn't ever say to God, why me? It just didn't feel like that was the reality. It was just, you know, why are my genetics somehow? I mean, maybe if there was any question, it was that. But, you know, but it was more really once I sort of grieved it, now the question was, how am I going to respond to this? And kind of what good can come from this? And who can I be in relationship to this and to him? And, you know, I've developed in many wonderful ways. And I feel honestly and genuinely very, very grateful to have Graham in my life, which still doesn't justify it in my mind, right? So that even though evolution has happened without any question, if I still could allow him to have a normal life, I almost hesitate to say that because there's so many wonderful things he brings to the world. But if he could have access to all those things, I would do anything to give it to him.
That is so wonderful.
There's a great quote that I really like from D.Z. Phillips, who I quote from all the time. But he says, there's a deep tendency in us to resist that we are not people to whom the cosmos owes anything. We refuse to believe that. We believe rather in a system of checks and balances that will make everything all right for us in the end. And then he quotes Simone Weil, who basically says that suffering is there to remind us that we're nothing. And he says, to recognize that one is nothing is to recognize that one is not the center of the universe. The eye is not sacrosanct, immune from harm. The world can reach out and touch it at any moment. Nor is the eye the possessor of a comic right that will guarantee that things will go in its favor. And what I like about this is, and it goes off what Jen said, is that I think too often, you know, when we want to say that, oh, God gave me this, it assumes that this whole, you know, and Jen talked about this, like that everything that played into that happening was some huge plan. I mean, the universe was specifically crafted so that this event could happen to me at this time. And and what's, as soon as we start to assume that God is doing that, then we want to take away all responsibility from anything, because we want to say, well, look, it's all up to God now. God gave me this. Now it's God's responsibility to take it away. And I no longer, and not only, and I'm so special that I should expect everyone else to recognize my place in this universe and that these things are owed to me.
Right. It's strangely narcissistic. In the face of suffering, there's still narcissism there. Right.
Mm-hmm. Well put.
Right. But one thing I would say about that quote is that, you know, while he's kind of giving two polar opposites, and I don't know if they have to both be true, that if you don't think you're the center of the universe that you are, then that we are all really nothing. And I would say, can we not still matter and not be the center of the universe, right? To matter, but to understand basically that we matter alongside of everyone else in equal measure.
Oh yeah, that's definitely the point he's trying to make, is he wants to say, look, and that's why he says, look, you know, you have to recognize that if something can happen to you at any moment, then it can happen to anyone else at any moment as well.
Yes.
And if you recognize that, then you recognize that there's far more obligation we have to others than. Whereas if the world's centered around us, then we really don't have an obligation to others.
Right. It's,
the universe is better for us.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Thank you for keeping calling us back to ethics, Lloyd. I love it. No, really great stuff. All right, guys, I want to head us out, but I kind of teased this last little section. So, Jen, I'm going to ask you a question, and you can just think about your therapeutic situations and stuff like that.
Sure.
And, Jim, let me call on you first. I'm remembering Nietzsche, who had this deeply melancholy personality, is constantly depressed. And there was somewhere in my philosophy background, I'm remembering that he read Schopenhauer, I think it is, and it cheered him up. Yeah. And so, Jen, what I want to ask is there something about a theology that basically asserts life is crap, things happen, you know, S-H-I, you know, happens, and even God is in the middle of this mess. So is there something that's cheering up? So, Jim, tell me the Nietzsche story just to make sure that I've got it right. But, Jen, I want to kind of throw – in a therapeutic situation, is sometimes that the best answer rather than God loved – you know, God gave this to you?
I don't know if anybody remembers Peter Appleby, used to teach at the University of Utah.
I do.
Was not Mormon, but, you know, was engaged with Mormons a lot. He used to have this little ditty that he would say about Schopenhauer, who was Nietzsche's first master in philosophy. If you crave a gloomy hour, read a little Schopenhauer. Nietzsche actually moves beyond Schopenhauer, though, and that Schopenhauer, you know, talks about how through music and through charitable activity, we can overcome the meaninglessness of the universe by just forgetting it for a while. Nietzsche actually moves beyond that and says we should embrace the meaninglessness of the universe, because if there is any meaning that's going to be to happen, it's the meaning that we are going to create out of the meaninglessness. We just have to realize that meaning's not going to be around after we're dead. Well, there is a kind of and then a way, you know, some Buddhist philosophers have talked like this. There's a way of, you know, I mentioned the Ozu movie, of just loving what is there, loving the world as it is.
Yeah.
Very Nietzschean sentiment.
Exactly. Yes. So Jen, maybe that was an unnecessary flourish for me to throw to Jim and all that stuff. But it's the question of, are there some clients that are just going to be far, far better off with just that sort of universe? Yeah,
I absolutely think so. I mean, you know, I don't need to go there with people that aren't struggling on this sort of larger level, or they're just trying to find meaning within a smaller struggle. But particularly when someone has had to confront a lot of suffering, that to just say, look, you're not special. It wasn't, don't take it personally. This is just the world that we live in, and you were very unlucky. And as harsh as that reality is in some ways, then it alleviates this sort of making it personal or feeling like that I somehow deserve this or that somehow God doesn't care about me. And I think, you know, back to this idea of a sort of a relational law, I'm not sure how to say that exactly, but this idea that basically meaning comes through who we are and what we choose within our relationships. So we can find the meaning by how do I respond to this suffering? How do I respond to this misery? And can I sort of reach for something better and create meaning and create grounding for myself in that process? And, you know, I think it's a very real thing that when people sort of rise up and do something different and better, even just with the people that they love or with their children, that it's very, you know, they live in a more satisfied way and they're, you know, the relationships become very grounding for them. So I think that it absolutely is better because it allows people to, in some ways, to forgive themselves for the evil that's come upon them.
Thank you. Now, Jim and Lloyd, let me ask you the question. Can Mormonism support that life is crap, you know, therefore embrace it, make it for yourself? Do you think our theology can go there? I know our discourse doesn't want to go there too often, but would you say that that's sort of embedded and inherent within the God who doesn't create out of nothing, you know, sort of universe? So is that fair Mormon theology?
Do you want to go first, or do you want me to go first?
I can go first. I think it is fair to a certain extent. And, you know, again, there's always strains going all over the place. But I think there is some fair to say, and I think that's what you see in that quote from Moses is, look, it's a world that's can be out of control, and meaning, you know, not in our control, not even in God's control, and things happen. And in fact, I think that's a lot of ways is how I read sections like 121 and 122 in DNC. It's not God saying, okay, here, Joseph Smith, I did all these things for good, but rather, look, these things happened, but you know what, buddy, you know, and I read it as if one friend talking to another saying, hey, look, you know, all these things happened, but guess what, man, it could have been worse, and you're going to pull out of this, so let's get going. And so I think there is definitely a place to say, yeah, you know, I think God faces that, you know, we're going to die, and in the next life we'll realize, oh, it continues on.
I'm going to appeal to Clint Eastwood.
Jim, I'll tell you crack me up with movies and pop culture, man. A great lit. I love it.
Well, think about this. You know, you got the early Clint Eastwood movies, like Dirty Harry and Pale Rider. And in those, the world is out of whack. A stranger enters the world and sets it back into order. Outside, you know, it's a very apocalyptic vision of how things work. Then the older Clint Eastwood, say Million Dollar Baby, Invictus, Gran Torino, maybe. It's these oddball characters creating a community out of a world that's out of whack and not working correctly. In a way, I think that's what he's got going on there, because you actually, if you look closely at the movies, even the bad ones, that's a theme that runs through all of them. It's just in the early ones, the apocalyptic is emphasized. In the later ones, what you could call like the communal meal is emphasized. I think that the second one is what we've sort of been talking about. And yet, I wouldn't want to give up the first one. I wouldn't want to give up the apocalyptic hope that sometime, who knows when, we'll arrive at the, you know, the perfect sociality. But maybe if we can combine them both somehow, that the perfect sociality is what Jen has described, is this just, you know, caring for each other, and caring for each other in all the suffering that happens. That's what Lloyd's been talking about too. And so that there is this kind of... you find this in Ozu's film, this kind of beauty that comes out of sadness. And I think, you know, that's what you get in what the passage you love so much from Moses chapter 7, that God weeps with the world. you know, and then eventually maybe we'll, you know, weeping is part of the beauty of the world.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. The William James quote, "Hey guys, I offer you the chance to take part in this experiment. It's a world not certain to be saved, but it may win through, but it's going to take all of our effort." You know, I just love that sensibility that we can kind of pick up that at least one thread. But I loved what you just said, Jim. That was wonderful. Mm-hmm. Hey, I want to give you guys all a chance to do a final thought. Lloyd, I'm going to throw to you first, so I'm going to have you say whatever you want to say. But while we're talking movies, let's do a little bit of something that you shared about the difference between Braveheart and The Passion of Christ. And that'll throw us, I think, in the direction of ethics and things again that you love, but you're free to close however you want.
All right, yes. I've been really interested in Mel Gibson's two movies, Braveheart and Passion of Christ, and how they both depict savior figures. You know, one's William Wallace, the other one is, you know, the savior Jesus. And yet, you know, and with my interest in liberation theology, I found how Braveheart, to me at least, depicts far better a depiction of Christ. In The Passion, it's the traditional Christian conception of the atonement, and that, you know, God, Satan is really the powerful one that God is trying to defeat, and God ultimately has to appease to Satan's demands of Jesus' death, and then that is the end. You know, so the whole point of Jesus' death is simply to die and appease Satan. And whereas with Wallace and Braveheart, his death is far more powerful because it evokes an entire movement and evokes a sense of, and what Christian theology in liberation theology, the idea that Jesus' death is important because it points to the life of Christ, going back to this ethics, points to the life of redeeming the poor, of liberating the poor, of bringing those who are oppressed, lifting them up, and how his death was a marker, because that was, in liberation theology, that was why he died, was because of that life he lived.
Well, there's one piece that you didn't say that I think you is right there, and that is, they don't kill you when you're not shaking things
up.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. When,
you know, so William Wallace was shaking things up, and he got killed, and so it's the shaking things up, and so his death meant something in the meaningfulness of this, whereas with the Mel Gibson thing, is the whole thing was just those last few days in order to work this atonement, and so the fact that he was shaking things up enough to get them to want to kill him, that's lost.
The Romans weren't interested in killing a hippie Jesus who was passing around flowers all the time.
Right.
And they were interested in killing someone who was a threat to their own power.
Right.
And bring this back to the problem of evil. If I were to leave anything, I think we should never read grand theodicies into the scriptures, because there's theodicies all over the place, but we should never take those and say, this is why suffering happens, or rather we should read those always as, this is how people are trying to deal with suffering, whether it's Alma and Amulek watching people being thrown into fire pits, whether it's Mormon trying to understand, you know, the meaning of these people who are dying in war, or Joseph Smith and Liberty Dell trying to understand, you know, what he and his followers are going through. We should never read a grand theodicy to say, this is what suffering means for everyone. We should always read it as, these are individuals struggling with their own and trying to find meaning and peace. And it may have worked for them, but it doesn't necessarily mean it works for everyone else. It doesn't necessarily mean that is what should work for everyone else.
I like that.
That was terrific. Thank you. And thank you for always pointing us to the only real response, besides the weeping and the mourning and the being present with others, is fight it.
Yeah, we can defend evil and suffering, or we can go up and say, all right, what are we going to do about it?
Awesome. Jim, can I go to you next for whatever's left, or how you'd want to summarize a final point or two?
Well, I guess, you know, the thing about any kind of discussion of the problem of evil is that I think problems emerge for any position we take. You know, like if we take the classical theist position, you know, the problems emerge that we've talked about. And if we take, you know, even if we take the Buddhist position, problems will emerge there too. They're just different problems. I think for Mormons, the problem's always going to be what we, you know, if we at different times of our lives, just what we've been talking about. That, you know, I when we talk about this with our, you know, traditional Christian brothers and sisters or Muslim ones, they'll always say, well, your God isn't strong enough to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. The problem's much different for us than it is for them. But that is a legitimate criticism to think, you know, the hope is that somehow, some way, we can come out of this. One of the things I love about the scriptures is they give us actually numerous answers, numerous different responses to this, because these are people trying to do the best they can with what they have. And I wouldn't want to let go of the apocalyptic one completely, that there would be a somehow a final solution to the problem of human suffering, an end in which we'd all get up in the great getting up morning and shake hands and be happy to see us, to see each other. And I guess Mormons can do that by thinking that God is just always on the job. God will stay there until the job is done, even if it takes forever. There's this wonderful little poem by Baxter Black called Cowboy Time, where he's worrying about evolution. And the angels and God says finally, I'll get the world done in 7 days, no matter how long it takes. And, you know, because that's what cowboys do. Right. But anyway, there's a sense there that that they have a hope of some kind of final fulfillment. But as Lloyd says, maybe that final fulfillment is when we all become so compassionate that we move to the next level of in the Mormon mythos of having children and spirit children and seeing them struggle and helping them struggle through it. Maybe it's just that kind of continual thing. But we arrive at least at the level that we have this peace in knowing that things will eventually work out.
Yeah. Terrific. Thank you. Jen, love to have you wrap up however you'd like.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think what I would say is that, sometimes being in the trenches with people, I have a lot of people ask me, how do you do this work? Because every day, I sit with the cruel things people can do to each other or the cruel things that have been done to them or both. And, kind of how do you hold hope when you see sort of the worst in people? And
you go to vacation in San Diego, like where you are right now.
Exactly. You go to the beach. But I think that strangely, I absolutely love what I do. And I very seldom feel overwhelmed by it. It is sometimes sobering to sit in those stories or to be in the presence of someone that you see their capacity to be cruel. But what I would also say is I have tremendous hope at the same time because I see how strong people can be, that while we're capable of enacting evil deeds and doing mean things to one another, we're also capable of very heroic, inspiring behavior, that we can really rise above ourselves and do much better and become the people that we can actually respect and that our spouses and our children can respect. And that in some ways it's quite remarkable to me the strength that we have as human beings and our capacity to transform our relationships and ourselves when we really step with faith towards what we believe is right, even though we're afraid of it. So, I guess I would say I do sit with the sadness of that, life is suffering, but also don't stop hoping because I see the strength that we have in our response to it.
Wonderful. What a panel. Man, we could keep talking, can't we? I'm not done, but we're going to have to be done. And I think we're going to end up in the 3-hour range. And Wow. Thank you. Thank you. Jen, thank you for taking time out of your vacation to do this. Jim, thank you for staying up well past midnight now. It's what, 1:30 in the morning for you? Holy crazy. Lloyd, thank you for bringing all that you brought to this. What an up-and-coming, brilliant, articulate guy. So I just loved everything that you've brought. So thank you.
This gave me lots to think about, so...
Yeah, wasn't this really neat? This was really neat.
Yeah.
You know, let me do my last little bit and just simply say, you know, listeners, Mormon theology is interesting. Yeah. You know, even when it's not clear, we don't have it wrapped up in a ball, there's this wonderful sensibility about the universe that just sort of feels right to me.
Yeah.
Or it just sort of feels like it. We're really confronting the nature of the chaotic, cruel, all life is robbery, every, you know, thing requires the death of another one for something, you know, whatever, the tooth and nail, or what is it, Jim, the blood red?
Yeah, nature, yeah, tooth and
nail. Yeah, something with red in there, too.
Matthew covered on Dover Beach.
Ours is a theology that, whether it's true or not, can speak well in this world, that can lead to an ethic, that can lead to healing. And I just wanted to, again, this is the kind of stuff that just has kept me, even in boring Sundays and putting up with, you know, discourse that doesn't match for me, I know that we've got this theology that's richer, and I just love that chance to explore things like this with the listeners here and with wonderful conversation partners like we have here. And I guess my last thought is that I hope we modeled in a fair way, and I'm willing to take criticism, you know, on the blog when people come. Spiritual adulthood. It's okay to challenge God. It's okay to curse the universe. It's okay to scream. It's okay to feel and to be angry and to challenge. And so hopefully within this we've taken scriptures and we've done fair discussions with them, even though we've maybe said that Mormon was a bad theologian. At least in my case, that's what I'm saying, at least in this part. Or, you know, or we have admitted that this is imperfect writers writing and trying to figure it out on the fly, and it's okay to not be committed to everything in there. I think if we start with the Mormon first principles and know that this is a universe of freedom and we have every bit of right to be here because we're as eternal as God is, man, this own our own power, own our own our own ability to make good things happen. So that's where I hope that somehow or other we were able to communicate and at least model to some degree here today. So you guys, please come to the blog. Share your own thoughts. I'm talking listeners there, but also Jen and Jim and Lloyd. I hope you guys will visit MormonMatters.org and respond to people's questions and engage there. Will you do it?
Yes.
Commitment pattern here. I get you guys there. No, I hope you will. And listeners, thank you for all of the things that you do to support. I love your notes and your letters, and I appreciate the fact that the podcast is helpful to you. That really is energizing. And if there's any money that comes attached with those good thoughts and thanks, that's pretty neat. My family and I are about to move, so this would be a good time to donate to the podcast. So that. Thank you for that, if you're so moved. Anything else, guys?
That's it. Thank you. I appreciate you inviting me.
Yeah, thanks, Dan.
Wonderful.
Yeah, nice talking to you folks.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. Thanks, guys, and I'll let you know when the podcast goes up. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.